So we start with intuitions and concepts. And so far, and remember that Kant's general strategy for solving all the main problems handed to him by Hume and Descartes and the problems with each of the two traditions, empiricism and rationalism, is to find something that the mind imposes on its representations as the price for our having them. And in the case of perception, right, he established that space and time were the forms, right, of all intuition. Well, time is the form of all intuitions, and space and time are the forms of all outer intuitions, right? And these are necessary formal structures imposed on all sense perceptions. Therefore, any world of possible experience must appear to be in space and time. It must have a spatio-temporal order, okay? So that's transcendental idealism. Space and time are the forms of outer and inner sense, respectively. And this is something that I know a priori by means of a synthesis in the pure manifold of perception, of intuition, by a series of arguments. And I haven't given you the detailed arguments. But the upshot is that intuition consists of sense, where we're talking about sense perceptions, it consists of sensation plus form, which is just plus space and time. Now, do I know yet that the world is objectively in space and time? Actually, I don't yet. In order to get anything objective, I have to add the contribution that concepts bring. Also, all the relationships that I can establish among my perceptions on the basis of what I know at the end of the transcendental aesthetic, all I can know is what is merely true for my mind because of the way it represents things to itself. And all of these relations are merely subjective. So my sensations come to me in a temporal order. And they also come with a spatial orientation, a spatial location. But that's a purely subjective fact about my experience, given what I know at the end of the transcendental aesthetic. The only thing in those things, the only thing I can say is that although it's a subjective feature of my intuitions, it's a necessary subjective feature. I can't be conscious of sensations that don't come in the spatio-temporal order, okay? So I know a universal principle of all possible perception, but what I don't know is that there is an objective world in space and time, that space, objective space and objective time have something that corresponds to them in the domain of my representations, in the domain of perception. Yeah, Clay.
Sort of touching on the thing in itself when you talk about space and objects.
Well, when I talk about objective things, the traditional metaphysical realist thinks that then we're now talking about things in themselves. So if space and time need to be things in themselves in order to be objective, Kant says, then we can't establish their objective existence. And we're stuck in a subjective world, right? And that would be the bad idealism. That would be what's called skeptical idealism. And that's what Hume gave us. We're in a world, it has necessary relationships, it seems, but we can't be sure that those relationships are real because the concept of all relations ultimately depends on the idea of the one kind of relation which the mind can, you know, needs in order to grasp all others, and from which it builds the idea of all others, and that's the idea of an association between two ideas. And that's a psychological contribution that the mind makes to incoming impressions as a result of our Pavlovian reaction to constantly conjoined resembling events of, you know, A and B, such that eventually we come to have an idea of A and B, and we take it that they are related to each other because when we think of A, our mind makes the these easy transitions in thought to the idea of V, and that transition eventually, the transcendental imagination reacts to that impression of reflection and starts to develop an idea, a new idea, the idea of their connection. And that becomes stronger and stronger until the transition in thought is so almost immediate and so natural and so vivid that we think of it as real as any impression of sensation. And it is. It's just a psychological relation between ideas in our head, in our minds. And these, we can't be sure, apply to objects of perception conceived as existing not as perceptions, but as things in themselves, right? So you're right to start thinking of things in themselves when I start talking about objective space and time. But here's the problem. Kant says that if space, well, actually, Kant, at the end of the Transcendental Aesthetic, has established, he thinks, by a sequence of arguments, that space and time are qualitative contributions of perception given to perception by the mind itself. So they're more like color than they are like what Locke called the primary qualities, the power in the object to produce effects in me that resemble them, right? It turns out space and time are only real because they are necessary formal features of all sensations, and the definition of reality for Kant is anything that's going to be real has to be something that the concept of which can be brought tied back to an original intuition containing sensation. It's the presence of sensation in an intuition available to consciousness, which is what we mean when we say something is real, he says. So as a result, since I have no sensations corresponding to space and time independent of the way they modify sensations to give them a spatial and temporal order, they are not objective in the metaphysically real sense. So the world, the things in themselves can't be in space and time, according to Kant, because space and time is more like color. And the thing in itself has to have something that's not... Color is a subjective feature of the way our minds respond to a certain kind of input, right? And we have a theory of color which tells us that it's not that there are frequencies of photons out there vibrating and bouncing around, right? Moving around at the speed of light and vibrating. And some of them are being absorbed and some are being reflected. And the reflected ones are the ones we see, right? See? But what we see are not vibrations, but that's what's real. So color, as we experience it subjectively, right, doesn't exist. What exists is something in us which corresponds to something that exists. Our eyes are like frequency detectors, but they don't reveal them. These frequency detectors do not actually tell us that what they're detecting are frequencies. It took scientific investigation to discover that the feeling of heat, the felt heat, and the look of brown is a certain frequency of light which gets translated into something we experience as the look of brown and the feel of heat, James.
So would it be correct to say that space and time exist universally and objectively, but just when our mind thinks about it, when we perceive it, it becomes subjective and no longer a pure...
Well, you're on the right track, basically, although they can't be objective even for Kant, because they are merely subjective features of something which is only to do with our power to be affected. Okay? The only part of perception that is properly... Well, the problem is that the only way you can get to objectivity is to incorporate concepts into our thinking about our representations, because until we have that, Kant thinks we can't have the idea of an object, of something persisting in the domain of perception, right, which we variously experience in different ways and which produce various intuitions in us, right, which are ultimately explained by that, you know, that continuing existing object, which stands as the common cause of all of these different intuitions. So you're right to suppose that space and time are real in some sense, because they are the form of what is real. Namely, sensation, conscious sensation, is the mark of reality concepts. That's where we get the idea of reality. So here he's just like Berkeley. So space and time, being a necessary adjunct to conscious sensation, because you can't be conscious of sensations if they aren't in space and time, because of the way our faculty of intuition works, right? Space and time are empirically real because they're the form of what is empirical, which, you know, the very essence of empirically real, which is sensation. But they're transcendentally ideal because they are not properties of the sensations themselves. They are rather something given to sensations by the mind itself. And the fact that the mind gives it to them, right, disqualifies them for transcendental reality. Okay? Because everything that's transcendental in the mind is something the mind has contributed to experience. So the only way we get real perceptions is the lucky break of having the ability to apply space and time as ordering, modes of presentation that have given order to our sensations so we can have any reality at all. Now, I want you to understand that when I say it's subjective, I'm not saying it's unreal. This is a bad way we hear in English, vernacular English, the word subjective. I'm not talking about something that is different for every one of you because it's subjective. Ananda's form of outer sense is just like mine and just like yours. We're all having the same experience, Susanna. We're all having sensations. Many of them are identical. When we look at this John shirt, we're all seeing, it's reasonable to suppose we're seeing the same hues. And it's organized in a common space, which we jointly experience. But it's not that it is subjective in that bad sense, that your space is different than my space is different than John's space is different than Luke's and so on, right? Mr. Yeager's space is just the same as mine because it's just as his colors, as in subjective qualitative qualia, you know, the qualia term, the look of red, the look of blue, are exactly like mine by hypothesis. And if they're different, the differences probably have to do with something's gone wrong with my eyes, that his eyes are still young and in good shape. But there aren't any significant differences here otherwise. And at the level of this theory of mind, there's no difference. So what makes space and time subjective is not that yours is different than mine, but that this is something which has to do with the way your sensations are presented to your consciousness, and does not, and we can't yet say anything about its causes in the world of your perceptions. Why not? Because all causes ultimately depend on there being objects. Everything in here is just appearances, representations, intuitions in you. In order to get away from that level of experience, to get from raw intuition, which is just, I mean, if you only had this part, but you were had a mind just like your own, so that it's all presented in a temporal and spatial ordering, but you were an oyster, so you couldn't reflect on it, you'd be an oyster. And your experience would be such that you could not interpret it, you couldn't think about it, because you wouldn't have any concepts with which to do that. This is a really important point. And it's not something that, short of doing this kind of work in epistemology, particularly in the early modern period, you'd ever notice. But it's not just the early moderns. Everybody realizes that that there's an important role that concepts play in human experience as we have it. As we ordinarily experience the world of our perceptions, right? It's a world that we maneuver through, recognizing some things, wondering what the hell that is about others, But even in the case where we see something we don't know how to interpret, we see it as something that deserves an interpretation, and we will, you know, and if we're and if we need to, we'll try. We will ultimately figure out what that is. We approach the world on the assumption that the world has patterns in it that can be cognized and which can be grasped and understood using concepts. So, in short, human beings, as we are, having experience as we have it, have more than just intuitions, conscious sensations presented in space and time. We also are able to think about them using concepts. We can form judgments about them. And the contribution of the faculty of judgment is essential to being able to discuss any propositions that can be objective. The very concept of objectivity, you notice, has the word object in it. And the idea of an object, Kant thinks, depends on something that only operates on the side of concepts. And the reasons for that are too complicated to try to get through in the Dilbert version of Kant's work here, so I'm not going to even try. But I'm just telling you that, in fact, the whole notion of an object as something continuing, self-unified, unifying, whole, the very idea of a whole depends on a concept which is and a mode of presentation that depends on a form of judgment called the form, and the form of judgment here is unity. And without that way of relating concepts, I couldn't think of any of my perceptions as being caused by others, because I need to be able to think of them as objects, as subsisting independent entities. And the problem is that if you're an oyster, you're not encountering entities, because the idea of an entity is the idea of something with a set of its own properties, unified and whole, and independent of any particular perception of it, right? So that's why Kant thinks that you need the faculty of concepts in order to have any kind of objectivity, because objectivity has to do with objects. So now, I can say something else, which is why space and time can only become objective if we can find a way to represent them in the world of our perceptions in a way that is, pertains to relations among objects. The reason is that space and time are merely subjective features of the way our mind, presents sensations to itself. And what I need are objective relations in space. In a persisting, real space. And since space isn't objective, I need something in the domain of perception that will stand in for space and stand in for time and do the work of unifying the world of objects of perception that is being done on the side of intuitions by the transcendental imagination, applying the form of space and time to all incoming sensations and thus unifying them, but only each one separately. Do you see that? They're only being kind of unified in the subjective order that we experience them. There is a unity of your stream of consciousness, right? Angela has a stream of consciousness and it has its own unity, but that's a merely subjective unity. That unity is not the same as Casey's. He has a different stream of consciousness, and his unity is no more objective than yours. There must be some unity, there must be some sequence of events that is independent of Angela's mind and Casey's mind, which, given that they jointly perceive, a world around them, often have, perceive things in common, like this table and my voice. There must be something in that domain that stands for, you might say, the objective order of time, right? There is an objective order of events in the world. And that order can't be altered by any of you, right? Which is why we can have a common history. even if we don't have exactly identical experiences, there wouldn't be any point in reading the newspaper if this weren't true, would there? Because the world they'd be talking about wouldn't be a world in which all the events occur in this, you know, in a unified, singular sequence in time and space, right? If I don't know if Spain is going to win the World Cup, but let's suppose that they do, right? Are they still in it? Spain is out. Germany's in. Germany's still in. Brazil's still in, right? So Brazil could win the world. But what if your Brazil is in some other place than my Brazil? We need all the Brazils to be in the same place. When you go visiting Brazil, you don't want it to be just your private Idaho. You want it to be the one and only Idaho that we all experience. Okay, so what I'm going to be trying to explain now is how we get, first, genuine, objective, causal relationships in a way that defeats Hume's claim that all... Because remember, Hume in the end says that all causal relationships are merely subjective features of each of our own minds, which we all can't help thinking that that various repeated experiences are related necessarily. But since the origin of that is merely in the way my mind responds to my experiences, even when you and I both experience causal relationships among common objects in our common experience, the necessity of the relationship among them is not objective. It's merely about how each of our minds responds similarly to similar events. But neither of us knows that there's a genuine necessary connection between the same objects of perception. So when you go to Haagen-Dazs to get, you know, chocolate chip, and you say, good, yeah, it's just what you said. And then we get to talking about how ice cream tastes so good. Our theories about that will be grounded in common experiences. And the kind of relations we'll be asserting exist between the ingredients and the way they're put together and the ice cream and the way it tastes will be in common. But the relations won't be relations that either of us can be sure exist in the ice cream. Kant thinks that we can do better than that. And here's how it works. Very roughly, remember that there's something a priori in perception, and it's what the transcendental imagination gives to sensations so that we can keep track of them and separate them out, space and time? Well, it turns out the faculty of concepts is this power to bring one idea under another in the category way. All right? So, right, I'm thinking of Nora under the category of college student. Both of you. Right? And when I do that, I'm engaged in an act of judgment, which I'm doing something by way of judgment, which is in the essence of judgment. Judgment is to bring one concept or one representation, because you can bring an intuition into under a concept, can't you? You can say, that looks red. Right? And when you do that, you're bringing an intuition, a red-looking patch, a manifold of red, under the concept of red. Similarly, slightly differently, since I don't think I have an intuition of the Noras, I think of them as actual... I have concepts of each of them. And those concepts are what I'm bringing under the more general concept of college student. And all of you I can bring under that concept, right? And when I do that, I'm doing what is essential to judgment. It's what the faculty of judgment does. It's what the faculty of concept is all about. It's about bringing one representation under another in a way that suggests that the other is a symbol for what that first idea has in common with other ideas. When I notice that the red, that red-looking thing is red, when I bring it under the concept of red, I'm now thinking of that patch of red, the intuition of red, under a concept. I'm bringing it under a representation which stands for anything that resembles that, right? I'm thinking of it in general terms. I'm using a general representation to stand for anything. What Locke said was a name that pointed to... Well, this is better than that. Here I'm using a faculty that gives me the power to think generally. It allows me to take intuitions and turn them into concepts directly by thinking of one under another. There are goofy ways I could do this. I could try to bring the idea of smoky barbecue smell under the idea of the sensible, another intuition, like the intuition of bubblegum flavor, you know, that taste of bubblegum. I could try to bring those into this. I could try to think of smoky, you know, smoky bacon smell under bubblegum taste. I could try to do that. I just don't get very far because they don't connect up, right? I mean, the idea of a smoky barbecue-flavored, bubblegum-flavored thing is pretty much disgusting, right? But it is conceivable that there might be a whole class of bubblegum. If I'm thinking about, if I'm bringing the smoky, that smoky barbecue smell, if I'm bringing it through judgment under the concept of bubblegum taste, what I'm doing is using an intuition of bubblegum to represent anything that could be a part of a concept of bubblegum that could contain things that smell smoky barbecue. Well, smell that way, okay? So the power of judgment actually is a power to generalize. And this kind of representation, our ability to combine ideas and put them in this kind of relationship so that one stands as a general representation for the other, is what we need in order to establish objective causal relations among our subjectively correlated perceptions. And here's how it works. There is something a priori in judgment too. It turns out that there are 12 things a priori in judgment. In the table of judgments, Kant tells his reader that there are 12 different relationships that can be thought through judgment. So there are 12 different ways in which I can think of concept A or idea, intuition A, by subsumption under intuition or concept B. And the 12, and among those, one of the relations, so judgment is just bringing ideas into relation to each other, to be more, speak more abstractly, right? All judgments have this form. This business of predicating S under P is what I'm talking about when I say you're bringing one idea under another one, right? You're predicating. When you predicate, you're bringing the subject concept under the predicate concept, okay? And that's what you do in judgment. Well, one of the kind of relationships that you can be articulating is this one. The one that's represented by the material condition. What in ordinary informal logic is referred to as the hypothetical condition. If this, then this. That's a relationship that you can bring two ideas into. It's a form of judgment, Kant thinks. If this is the case, then this is the case. He thinks of that as bringing the idea of each of these under the idea of a conditional and thinking of them as having this relationship. Now, there are 12 of these forms of judgment. That's just one of them, okay? So there are 12 of these, 12 forms of judgment. And one of them, one is the hypothetical conditional. I just showed you. Hold on to that for a bit while I tell you some other things. It turns out the forms of judgment are determined by the faculty of concepts itself. There might be a mind with a capacity for judgment, for bringing ideas into relation to each other, which would have only 8 forms, or one that had 15 forms. If it had only 8, it might be one of the 8 of the 12 that we know, but it might not. It might have some new ones. as you can see, if you consider that there might be one that has 15, obviously the extra three would have to be different than any of the ones that we have. So Kant thinks that our minds, he thinks he's discovered by doing some work on traditional logic, looking at the logical relations that we seem to be able to think. So here what we're doing is inspecting to see what sorts of relations between ideas we can think. He thinks there are 12. And these are determined by the faculty of concepts itself to be 12. Now, suppose that these relationships, suppose the ways that you can form judgments, the 12 ways, what if I could show that there was a way in which those forms play a role in constructing the objects of perception? Not the individual intuitions, but those complexes of intuitions that we are talking about when we talk about things like the table, right? Because this table is not a single intuition. It's a complex of intuitions organized in the object way, right? And what if I told you that Kant has an argument to show not only that the mind constructs, the faculty of concepts plays a role in constructing how we think about the objects of perception, but it actually helps to build them. In just the way that sensations are built into a spatiotemporal subjective order, the faculty of concepts, the faculty of judgment, plays a role in structuring how objects of, how intuitions are synthesized over time into objects. So you can think of it this way. The possible relations that can exist among objects of perception, including all those relations between an object and its various parts, one of the relations, one of the forms of judgment is the part-whole relation. Okay? This is a part of that. That part-whole relation is a relation which is given to all objects that have parts, have that are whole and have parts, by the same transcendental imagination, applying the forms of judgment to the synthesis of intuitions in the manifold of experience. Except that what's being connected together now are not relations between individual intuitions, but between individual intuitions and other intuitions. So the key idea is this. The life of an oyster just involves a stream of sensations, each of which is distinct, and all of which are related subjectively by the transcendental imagination, putting them in time and space. Okay? No? Yes. If you're an oyster, your experience is still a stream of discrete intuitions of sensation. And because the transcendental imagination imposes the form of space and time on any sensation as the price for you being conscious of it, and the oyster is just like you in this respect, the oyster has an order of perception. But that order is merely subjective and only consists in the apparent temporal and spatial orderings of these discrete, otherwise completely discrete, manifolds of sensation, these discrete perceptions. So the only relations among perceptions, between perceptions, that are accounted for by the forms of space and time are those subjective, temporal, and spatial orderings between individual intuitions. They don't have any other relations. But suppose that I think that one thing I saw a long time ago, now I'm a really smart oyster, something I saw a long time ago, I think resembles something I saw recently, such that I think they might have a common cause. Now I'm starting to think of relations that go beyond the merely subjective, temporal, and spatial order of these discrete intuitions. Right? Now I'm trying to organize relationships among my perceptions that jump across time and across spaces, right? I don't continuously experience this desk, but every time I come back here, it's in the same place. How do I think about that relationship? For me to do that, I have to be thinking of relations between my distinct, my otherwise completely distinct intuitions of outer, my outer intuitions, and relations of which I'm not immediately aware of. Those relations are all built up thanks to the work of the faculty of judgment, which creates rules for how you can combine intuitions into relations that are not merely spatial and temporal and subjective, right? But which cross the subjective, temporal, and spatial boundaries of my actual experience to establish other kinds of relations. So the very simple story is this. The only relations among your perceptions that you can be aware of, if you're only an oyster, are those, is the literal temporal order and spatial, you know, array of the perceptions as you experience them. And those are the only relations that exist for you. But you and I can experience all kinds of relations, right? Some of them causal, right? I experience this table as having a whole bunch of relations. Like, I think of this table as having a relation, having the part-whole relation. There's the whole table, and then there are all the various parts of it, and they are all a part of it, and so they have this relation being a part of. That relation is a relation among perceptions which I do not immediately perceive in many cases. And in fact, I'm not now, because when I'm thinking of the table, I'm not actually thinking of just what I'm seeing right now, but of something else, which is a unity of a bunch of discrete parts, some of which I've never seen. The very idea of that unity requires an idea coming from the faculty of judgment, and is impossible for an oyster. So the very idea that there's anything in the world that persists in the domain of perception when I'm not perceiving it depends on the idea of an object in general. And that idea is a construction produced by the mind's own activity using the forms of judgment, because the forms of judgment are the only forms that will do the trick. Why? Because these relations are not relations among individual occurrent perceptions, but between perceptions over time and space, between distinct, discrete times and spaces, right? And those relations are not immediately available to the faculty of apprehension. They have to be, they're only available because I can think of these things as being related to each other, right? Which is how Locke and Hume accounted for our judgments about all of the objects and how they come to exist. Remember when I told you that Locke says that you get the concept of this individual table by walking around it enough times to get a whole bunch of different ideas of perception, ideas of simple ideas of sensation, which you ultimately take to be unified in some way? You think they have a common cause? You construct the idea of the table from what you literally perceive. You never perceive the togetherness of the parts of the table. That rather is something that you conceive. And so Kant says that the object, my experience of objects presupposes that there is a synthesis on the side of judgment, which is somehow being applied to the construction of the objects of experience, and must be in operation even when I'm, you know, simply paying attention to what I'm perceiving right now, right? Just a stream of sensations. But Kant says that because I have a faculty of concepts, and because there are a set of 12 relations that the faculty of concepts can think, 12 possible relations that are thinkable for reasoners like us. And you know, you could roughly say that the faculty of concepts and judgment is just the faculty of reason as applied to ideas of experience, ideas drawn from perception. The idea that that solves Hume's skeptical problem about causal relations among the objects of experience lies in Kant's insight that there's something Kant eventually realizes that there's a way to show that the forms of judgment actually produce a formal feature in perception, among perceptions, and that this formal, these relations are actually imposed on individual perceptions as a condition of our consciousness of them, in very much the same way that the form of space and time is imposed on individual sensations as a price for bringing them together into a manifold, into it, so that we can have perception. But the relations between perceptions, which all of us experience, are there. Those relations are relations you can experience because these relations are imposed on incoming intuitions, again by the transcendental imagination, using the forms of judgment as a schema for constructing the objects of your experience. So not only is the mind generating the spatial and temporal mode of presentation, which constrains the form of all conscious sensations, it also actually is producing all possible relations among separate perceptions. And it's creating a structure for the world of your perceptions out of them, which exists only because your mind requires them as the price for you being conscious of diverse individual perceptions having relations to each other, other than the immediate subjective relations they have. So those relations are given to the objects of perception. The reason you experience this table as an object is because you have forms of judgment that require that all your perceptions ultimately be thinkable in terms of objects. And if you didn't have that form of judgment, you wouldn't experience this as an object. You would actually experience it the way an oyster does. And an oyster has no objects, because the idea of an object requires concepts of persisting entities unified and continuing independent of your own conscious encounters with them. Well, look, I have the... I'm getting the tilt sign flickering behind the eyes of many of you, and I think I should just concede that this is probably as good as I can do in trying to convey to you this part of Kant's view. But Kant thinks that he's discovered something universal and necessary on the side of judgment, which actually plays a role in constructing your experience in the way that space and time are constructing a part of your experience by being given by an active part of your mind to your, you know, to your individual, you know, snap, you know, visual snapshots, auditory snapshots, and so on. But even the relations you think exist among those diverse, separate snapshots of perception are relations that are made possible by facts about the way your mind produces representation. So again, it's something that the mind is putting into experience, and what the mind puts into all experience, it can take back out. So in fact, one thing it puts in is the idea of a hypothetical conditional, which means all of your perceptions, for you to be conscious of any of them, must stand. All of them must stand in a causal relationship to at least some other possible perceptions. And if they didn't, you couldn't be conscious of them. And that solves Hume's problem. So that's that solution. Now I'll give you the other solution very quickly. It is still possible that I'm just having a very organized and orderly dream. If that's the case, Kant says, now, in fact, it turns out that in order for you to be conscious of yourself in time, there must be something that your mind represents as existing permanently in the background in order for you to be able to keep track of yourself, because you need something fixed in perception against which to contrast your progress. It's sort of like the idea that you can't perceive emotion if there isn't something that's not moving, that's standing in relation to your perception of the motion, right? Something has to stand still Something has to be standing still for you to notice emotion. Similarly, if you're going to be aware of the different states of your own consciousness over time, there must be something fixed, permanent, absolutely permanent, and unchanging, which continues to exist throughout that change. And since it can't be your mind, it must be something outside your mind. It must be something objective. It must be an external world governed by causal laws, completely unified, completely explicable, although maybe not by you, but capable of being understood because it's organized in a lawful way, and the laws and the lawfulness of that world is imposed on your experience by the 12 forms of judgment. Yeah. So it turns out that as long as I can take note of my own existence over time, and that is an object. I am an object, okay? I'm an object of my own experience. Myself is an object in my world. And that object, I'm able to keep track of. Can't you? Everybody here can. The fact that you can do that means there must be a world existing independent of your inner consciousness, out in the domain of perception, which is permanent, rule-following. And that's what we mean by an external world. Therefore, the external world exists. And you can establish it simply by following two of your thoughts and seeing, and then deriving from that that you exist and that you have this history, this two-moment history. So that's the story according to Dilbert. Yeah.
Just to try and clarify this a little bit. Hume's understanding of unity as being like that psychological factor that we're not entirely sure how it works. It's just like, I see that table as an amalgamation of smaller perceptions of that table.
Yeah.
But and so is
Kant. I mean, I don't see it. I don't see it as an amalgamation. I think of it because
Exactly. Yeah. So is Kant just simply redefining what he's talking about as psychological as being these 12 forms of judgment?
This is a deeply psychological account.
That is similar to time and space as constructions of the mind themselves.
Yes. It just turns out that the psychological part is a universal and necessary one. It's not a Pavlovian contingent relation. So what Kant has done is to replace contingent relations that are psychological with universal and necessary relations, he thinks. He thinks Hume's psychology is a rational psychology. It's empirical psychology. And therefore, it's only as true as the contingent facts support it. He thinks he's discovered a set of necessary truths about our minds, which require that it churn out that space and time are constructed by the mind itself. And I'll tell you that one of the interesting things is that no matter how far we get in natural science, I don't think that this theory, on the basis of any empirical evidence, could be refuted. Because it would be in its nature that it would be consistent with any possible account of how actual minds are created by brains and all of that. You can just think of this as, well, and here's the way that brain must function in order for minds like ours to function the way ours in fact do. And by the way, and maybe Nora can support me in this, cognitive science proceeds these days in psychology and in linguistics and in philosophy entirely in the same way that Kant's approach to the human mind does. Namely, by saying, what is it? Here are the things that we are able to do. How is it possible that we're able to do them? And then you start generating hypotheses. Sometimes using things you've learned about the brain. But all of these ultimately are attempts to figure out how to account for things that we already do. What would have to be the case in order for me to be able to keep 12 different shades of blue in mind at once and distinguishable? And there are experiments that attempt to try to apply a theory of how that must be, how it must work. Same thing with the tripartite model of memory. So a good deal of cognitive science proceeds on this kind of a deeply Kantian hypothesis, where you start with what you already are able to do, and then you say, well, what would have to be the case in order for me to be able to do that? What would have to be the case in order for me to be able to keep track of all the sensations I have and keep them apart, to kind of question I was asking you to consider when we were talking about the role time might play, the role time plays in Kant's view, in making perception like ours possible, in part, by giving us a way of representing sensations so that they can be distinguished from each other in consciousness. And that's an example of the kind of reasoning which is all over the place in cognitive psych. And very productive. Now, of course, they also conduct experiments because they're interested in how brains like ours produce minds like ours. And that will be an empirical investigation. Well, I now am prepared to talk about anything. We only have about, I think, 10 minutes left. But I'm happy to, without answering any specific questions on the final, I'm happy to try to refresh your minds about, I mean, if you have some things, I know the final, so if you want to just ask some questions. Yeah, Nora?
One of the true-false questions you asked if the content of perception is exhausted, if Kant thinks the concept of perception is exhausted by the context of sensation.
And you wonder what the expression is exhausted means?
Well, I know what it means, but I don't understand what it means in that context.
Well, another way of putting it would be to say, does Kant think that, what exactly is the question?
For Kant, the content of sense perception is completely exhausted by the content of sensation.
Right. So in other words, does Kant think that all there is to sense perception is sense perception nothing more than sensation?
Okay.
Make sense? So that's what that convoluted phrase means. Right? No other questions? I'm just all tired. I know I'm tired. I don't know how you guys can do this. If I were at the summer school, I would go in the B term. I've always taught B term. It's the first time I've taught A term. And it was great at first, because you have the momentum of the spring semester going for you. But you get tired after a while. 2 weeks off and then boom, every day, 4 weeks straight. And some of you are doing two courses.
Maymaster.
Oh yeah, well, I don't even want to think about what that would be like.
Well, Maymaster, now I'm doing two courses.
You can only take one, but I can't imagine teaching a Maymaster then, which is really intensive. You know, what is it? 2 weeks?
Three weeks
as it overlaps with finals, right?
There's nothing academic about it at all.
And I would just, I would have an aneurysm. Yeah, Steve.
Could you clarify, maybe four parts of the essay? It says, why does Dave Eaton offer a critique of the constants of realist and or rationalist belief that there are real causal relations among objects and events in the world that depend on our minds?
Yeah.
Are you looking for a piece of evidence that motivates him to write it?
Yeah, he has a reason for thinking that they can't be right. And so, yes.
So he's right, because he found some counter evidence.
Yeah.
So you want to know this.
I want to know what motivated him to think that their view was a problem. Yeah. So it's really just it's part of the first stage of the critique. Make sense?
There's a short answer question. It's not all four. It says like at all in the question.
Oh.
All right.
Et al. Just refers to all other members
right.
of some group.
So it said like for Descartes, comma, Locke, but I wasn't sure if you meant for all of them or if you meant just for the first name.
It would be all of them because it applies to et al.
Okay,
so it's everybody
okay.
together.
For all of them.
All of these thinkers think X.
Okay.
Right.
Well, I had that one highlighted too. It says according to Kant, comma, Hume and Locke and Descartes, I was uncertain if it's according to Kant. And he's looking at Hume and all the others? Or is it...
Is it according to Kant?
Are we looking at Kant's view on these others?
No, it is. According to Kant, these guys...
Okay,
yeah,
so according to Kant, those things.
Yeah, according to Kant, these guys think blah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks. That was the one I was thinking really.
It would have been easier if I put the second phrase first, right?
Yeah.
These guys think blah. Says Kant.
Or
right?
According to Kant, following.
That would have been a little easier to follow. Well, I'll see all 15 of you hungry beasts tomorrow. For those I don't see, sayonara.
Can you maybe bring the quiz for the quiz for today tomorrow? Is that sure. Like, too soon to turn around?
No, no.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll bring it with me.
Thanks.
And anybody who isn't coming who wants to know what they got can just email me.
We're going to work on a mistake, and in addition to a mistake.
Okay.
For mercy.
Okay. Oh, we got it. Sure. Mercy is always possible.
I didn't actually look at it until I was studying and trying to make mistakes. So unicorn has objective reality according to Empire. Example. Unicorn has objective reality.
Well, but see, these were examples and we were going through them and saying, is that true or not?
And
that was
so
one that was false. So this wasn't like all the true ones. Because of course
I was assuming
the normal
these were,
reality of unicorn.
I thought these are true examples.
No, no.
Only the idea of a unicorn.
This is the problem
objective
charts.
Reality.
Right? There's so many ways to interpret them.
And then I was wondering if I could either get some feedback and exactly, I mean, clearly,
okay.
I'm always on the side of person.
All these are some, we get the ideas from the senses, use abstraction, and thus we're able to build from acquisitions. The missing piece here is that the complex ones are...
No.
Built up from the simple ones by abstraction. It was just that one piece. Because it isn't like I can construct simple ones from complex ones. That's not the order. It made it sound like all of these were.
I think some of the assumptions. That just isn't what
I know. I guess. I know. But look, I mean, I'm happy to give you a class. I'm happy to remind me. I don't feel
like
that.
Yeah, I'll just.
A minuses.
Yeah, yeah.
B's. So well, I'm doing that.
Really?
Well, oh yeah. I mean, I transferred out as a senior, so I'll barely, I mean, I'm going to be knocked out of PhD programs and I'll barely get into master's programs, so I'm just trying to short. So,
well,
I'm just
sure.
Whatever
I do. I know you did very well on the other quiz, and so I'll let you face
that. Well, I'll give my best.
All
right,
right, thanks. Yeah, but, you know, email me and I'll bump that.
Okay.
Just technical, and I could be losing my mind, but I think on the final it said due at midnight tomorrow, and then I could have sworn it said due July 2nd, 12 p.m. So I don't know if that could create a problem.
I think everybody knows. Because what would be the point of making it due before class?
You would think.
And I guess I
thought I mentioned it.
Anywhere, so.
Yeah, that's right. It's 0 p.m., I guess. I don't know. What is it, 12 a.m.?
I guess, yeah.
All right, I guess it's 12 a.m.
I was like, if I don't mention it.
You know why I don't know things like that? Because I've been setting my watch when I had one to 24 hours. And so everywhere I use 24 hours, and then it is 0. But I was trying to. That was a screw up. I will send out a quick email just reminding everyone it really is midnight. I mean it.
All right, thank you.
Sure, see you anyway.